Your New York weekend is not complete without the Joan Hamburg Show on 77 WABC.
Welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show every Saturday at 2 o'clock. And by the way, get your tickets for our fabulous Broadway show, a celebration of all the great entertainment in New York City. But you need a ticket June 5th. Fabulous lunch, 212-613-3848. And guess what? By listening today, we may provide you with a partner. Everyone wants someone. And my guest says you got to learn how to do it during the digital age, and she'll tell you. We'll talk a little bit about aging, and famous star Betty Buckley promised to drop in. So a great show on a great Saturday. It's Memorial Day weekend. Let's celebrate together.
Backstage with Broadway's best. Behind the curtain with Joan Hamburg on 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
You know, if you ask Tony Award-winning Broadway star Betty Buckley what she's doing these days, you better have a long time to listen, because Betty is doing more than ever. She's got a new live album, Hope, which she's going to tell us about. She's going to be at Joe's Pub celebrating this. She's doing a performance workshop. She's on a big TV show. Everything. Betty, nothing has changed, right?
Hi, Joan. How are you?
I'm good. And I know you're fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much. I've been having a really good time doing such fun work.
My gosh. And what about, did I hear you were also going out with Hello, Dolly?
Right. I go to New York to start prep and rehearsals at the end of July. And we open in Cleveland in October. So, and then we're on the road until like the end of the first week of December. And then we have 3 weeks off. Then we hit the road again in early January to the end of August.
How on earth do you do all that?
I'm a little daunted by the notion of being on the road for a year with Dolly, but I'm just starting my prep work on that now, and yeah, I have a long ways to go.
Yeah, so. But how much fun. Actually, it would really be an interesting time to look at the face of America.
Yeah, I've been thinking the same thing, Joan. My catchphrase for Dolly, yeah, have you seen the New York, the new Broadway production? Because it's just glorious.
Yeah, of course. We love it.
Oh, it's so, I felt rapture. I felt such joy when I saw it. I thought it was spectacular.
I know.
One of the best pieces of musical theater I've ever seen.
And
I was crying
from you.
Joy at the end of the show. So when Scott Rudin, the producer, called and said, offered me the tour, I was so honored. I felt really delighted. But I said, my job is to, when taking Dolly on the road, is to make America happy again.
That's, you know what? But that's why, not only Dolly, which absolutely loved, I've seen it two times already since it came back, but all the shows that we grew of, you know, came into our own with My Fair Lady and Carousel and the glorious music that we need to hear now, this reaffirmation
is
so important. Tell me about Preacher. In addition to everything else, this is what? Have you been in it for the third season?
Yeah, I got the part in January, and I went immediately to New Orleans. I played the role of Grandma, Jessie Custer's grandma. Jessie Custer is our lead, played by Dominique Cooper, who's the preacher. It also stars Ruth Negga, who was nominated for an Oscar last year, and a wonderful Irish actor named Joseph Gilgan. And it's just, I've been a huge fan of the show for the first two seasons. I love, love, love the show. So I was ecstatic when I got this job. So this character, her name is Madame Marie Langelle. She's a Cajun sorceress, and has a lot of really big skills, not the least of which is she's capable of bringing people back to life. And
that's a good one.
You know, it's for a price, of course. But she also is very ruthless and mean. And I mean, she's very cruel and evil gal. But it's a wonderful role, and I was really excited to play it and get to work with these incredible actors. And the crew in New Orleans was one of the nicest groups of people I've ever worked with. All of them just so dedicated to their work and so good at what they do. And the production team, headed by Sam Catlin, the showrunner, producer, writer, also he directed our last episode, is just a brilliant guy and such a nice man. So I just got home on Saturday after my last day of shooting on Friday. I have to go back this Thursday to do some special effects makeup things on Friday. And then the wrap party is Friday night. So.
Wow. And how was being in New Orleans for this time?
Well, I really enjoyed it. There are so many great restaurants.
Yeah, the best.
Yeah, just fantastic food there. Beautiful restaurants. And, we had a really good time. I was working pretty hard, you know, sometimes like 14-hour days. But it's such a great job. And I'm sad that it's over, you know, because it was so much fun.
So it's done for the season. Thank goodness, because there's no way you could go out on the road. And with all that you've got coming up, tell me about Hope.
Well, it's a beautiful collection of songs, the centerpiece of which is a song called Hope that was written by Jason Robert Brown. And he's, of course, one of my favorites from the musical theater, but it's just a really moving song. And my wonderful collaborator, Christian Jacob, and I, we did the arrangements together, make the selections together, and we worked on it for about 6 months. It's some really pretty songs, you know, and we put this together as a grouping of songs for a concert at Joe's Pub last fall, and I called my record company and said, you know, I think this is some really pretty music, and they said, yeah, let's make a record. So we did another live recording. Our last recording, Story Songs, was a 2-CD set that was released a year ago, April, and this one they're releasing on June 8th. So we're going to do 4 concerts at Joe's Pub, June 5th, 6th at 7 p.m., and June 9th at 7 and 9:30 p.m. So we're doing 4 concerts at Joe's to celebrate the release of this live album.
Right, and it's a wonderful venue, too. And by the way, Betty is going to do performance workshops. And you can find out all about this, that's from June 2nd to the 8th, by going on to BettyBuckley.com. So with everything, 10 million things before breakfast, what happened to the horses?
Well, I just got home. In fact, I'm going to go ride them as soon as we get off the phone. They were happy to see me. I'm happy to say most of the time when I go away for a long time, which in this case, I got back in the middle of the 4 months to visit with them, but for about a week. But I've been virtually gone for 4 months, and so when I went in to see them,
they
were real happy to see me. I felt like they were smiling, and they were giving me all kinds of nibbles and kisses, so I felt like I was somehow forgiven.
I know.
They finally got the concept that I'm the girl that has to go out and work for their grain and hay.
That's right, to keep them in the good stuff. But Betty Buckley, don't tell them you're going on the road with Dolly. Yeah. They will not be happy horses.
I know. That was a tough one to figure out. Fortunately, Scott Rudin is letting me and my assistant bring our dogs. And,
you're kidding.
A big dog lover. But one of the jokes during the negotiation was, how are they going to stable the horses?
That's right. Scott would be surprised when you showed up on tour with your horses as well as the dogs.
We were saying, we think Dolly should ride in on a horse, not a subway or not a streetcar.
That's actually, I like that. That's a great idea. Well, at least you know that they'll find you good accommodations.
Yeah. Yeah, I get to sleep in the manger of the barn.
Right. It's got to be big, though.
That's a compromise.
Well, I'm very excited for you, Betty.
Thank you so much, Joan.
Love
I'm so, always so happy to talk to you.
And we'll talk again real soon. Good luck on the tour.
Thanks, my dear.
All the best.
Take care.
I'm Joan Hamburg. This is WABC.
New York culture with real New Yorkers. Joan Hamburg. 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
One of the country's leading media personalities and former editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan and Marie Claire magazine, Joanna Coles, has done a great service. She has written a book called Love Rules, How to Find a Real Relationship in a Digital World. You know that if we did nothing but talk about matchmaking every day, our audience would be very happy. Everyone wants to know where, how, what. Can you really find love these days? What are the rules? And you did it. I'm very curious. What made you? Was it Cosmo that inspired you to try to find the story behind the story?
Well, Joan, I had talked to literally hundreds of young women at my time at Cosmo. I was going out on college campuses. I was talking to young women business groups. And there was a lot of dissatisfaction in their relationships. And they were being told that they had to find a man that would, or a woman, because the book is radically inclusive, a partner, let's say, who would share things 50-50. And they were finding that very difficult. And of course, what's very exciting about living in the digital age is the availability of dating apps, which allow people to connect with all sorts of people that they would never have connected with otherwise. So the upside is there are many more opportunities. The downside is they can feel that you're interchangeable and disposable. And if you're only using dating apps, it can be a bit depressing. And I wanted to remind people that falling in love, which was not a phrase I was hearing much of anymore, is the best thing that can happen to you. It's exciting. It's what makes you feel alive. And I wanted to remind people of the value of slow love, of looking for love, hiding in plain sight with maybe your brother's best friend or your friend's brother, and not only to be looking for the one on a dating app, brilliant though they can be.
Right. And it's also, in these times, hard to identify what you really want in your relationship, as well as, okay, we have all these apps, but is that really where we're going to find it?
Yes, and I think one of the suggestions I make in the book, which follows the lines of a sort of diet book, is to keep a love journal, or to keep a journal on your life where you can write to yourself about the things you want in your life. And this is where you can admit the things that you want that you don't actually have to tell your friends. This is a quiet place where you can reflect on what's working in your life, what's not working in your life. And once you've built up a few weeks or several months worth of entries, you can begin to see patterns in your own behavior that isn't necessarily making you happy. And I think that it's a really valuable thing to do. And again, I think we've got out of the habit of doing it.
But then, even keeping journals and things, how do people really identify what makes them happy? I mean, happy is a warm chocolate chip cookie. You know, I mean, there are so many ways to feel happy, and happy is often a moment. Can people be truthful about that?
Well, that's a very good question. And I would argue that happiness might be a warm chocolate chip cookie. And then half an hour later, the remorse you feel for having eaten
exactly.
it, or the downer for having eaten it because you've been on a sugar high, isn't worth the momentary happiness. So I think what you're trying to figure out is what's missing in your life, what's working about your life, and what would be something that would add pleasure to your life. And I think, especially in the age of Me Too and time's up. There's this pressure on women to feel they can do everything themselves. And life is much more fun when you share it with people. And what's fascinating is that all the studies around longevity and how people live longer and how they live fulfilled lives, really, it comes down to two things: your DNA and your genetics, which is very hard to do anything about, and actually the quality of your real life relationships, who you love and who loves you back. And I worry that we're living in a time where we are encouraged to build up a group of anonymous followers on our Facebook pages or on Twitter or on our social media, which really are of very little value and come at the expense of the time we should be spending with loved ones, with family, with friends.
But let me ask you this, and you brought up the Me Too, and recently 60 Minutes did a story on Mario Batali and all these women coming forward years later and, you know, willingly meeting him in private rooms, you know, and then you're being traumatized by what happens. And I'll often hear, because we work in a sea of young people, saying, well, you know, I had a date, he was okay, I went back to his apartment. What is it where everything is so like, yawn, I went back to the apartment, and then they either, you know, pay a big price for that, or it's just another how do you really get to know someone when you live like that?
Well, I think one of the things I'm trying to encourage in the book is to get offline and do things with people. Join clubs, join choirs. If you think about how we live at college, you're doing your schoolwork, right, and then you're in a team. You're in a sports team or you're in the theater club. And you have things that are sort of organized in your social life. People leave college, they go into the workplace, they've got work, but then your social life tends to revolve around just meeting people in bars or meeting people and going out for supper, and socializing without any great point to it. And I think there is so much to be said for joining a sports team. It doesn't really matter if you're any good at the sport. The
right,
point
just
is to
do
have
it.
Fun, right? And to do things with other people, because that creates a different kind of energy. You're meeting people. You're not necessarily looking for the one. But the goal is to have a big life. And the bigger the life, the more likely you are to meet other people. You will be contributing to something bigger than yourself. And there's nothing more fun than being with a group of people and you all creating a big project together. And it might be a winning team. It could be you're baking cakes for the local orphanage.
But it's a commonality.
Exactly. And it's something that takes you out of yourself and it allows you to see the best in other people and them to see the best in you.
Joanna Coles, Love Rules. So you say to the women who are reading this book, you've got to know yourself first. And you had mentioned a little bit earlier about keeping a journal, what you're feeling, how do you feel, when are you the least happy, and if you do go out, do you want to go back with a guy, do you have sex right away, how long do you take this hard look at yourself? Do you spend months at it? Is this something like a diet, as you mentioned, you do on a daily basis?
I think that you want to take a look at yourself all the time. You want to be paying attention to your behavior all the time, not so that you become a great bore and you're talking to other people about it. But I think if you're keeping a journal, it's worth trying to do it two or three times a week, because otherwise you won't have enough information to really track. And we're all supposed to be data analytics experts now. Well, make yourself and your life the data. And you can talk it into a cell phone. You don't have to write it in a quill pen every night with great seriousness, but really jotting down observations about your own life. And this is something we should all do. And I think Joan, one of the things, and I know you've talked about this on your show before, but we're definitely seeing people going to church less, going to temple or mosque less. So there's less of a sense of us living in communities that care about each other. And there are fewer places for us to go together and experience a collective, if you like, understanding that there are all sorts of questions that we don't have answers to. And instead, on Sunday mornings, people now go for a run, or they go to the gym, or they
solitary
Starbucks. Right. But these are not areas where we're encouraged to think about what keeps us connected to each other. And I worry that our relationships are getting shortchanged with the promise of us being able to do things on our cell phones and connect with people instead, and that we're now living life almost at one removed and becoming voyeurs of other people's
right.
lives and not participating in our own.
Right, and thinking that Facebook and Twitter, that these are your real friends, when most of them have no clue whom you are.
They're not your real friends, and you know, your real friends are people that you have to show up for, and you might not feel like showing up. They might not want to listen to you whining on about your latest problems, but that's what friends do. They turn up in wedding parties, they are godparents to your kids, they hold your hand when you're having chemo, and the value of that is enormous and much more sustaining over the long haul than collecting, you know, 2,000 strangers on your Facebook page.
I'm talking to Joanna Coles, who was editor-in-chief of Cosmo. Marie Claire is one of the leading media people in the country. In her new book, she's got really basic, simple guidelines for finding something which you think is as elusive as love. She has rules. She talks about dating apps. But then you say something which is interesting, because my own children are so terrible with the phone, like it doesn't exist. And I find that we're among the few people who still have land phones. It's like, what's a land phone is going to be the next generation. Why do you suggest that people should call on a phone if, let's say, you found someone from a dating app?
Well,
so before you meet them, call them.
Exactly. I think it's incredibly important to call people once you've met them online, because why invest the time in a meeting offline until you've talked to them? Because on the phone, you will be able to figure out, is this someone that you actually think you could have a great conversation with? Is this someone worth your emotional calories? The calories you're going to invest having a drink with them, or spending time getting ready, having your hair done, putting on makeup, you know, taking an evening out of your life and investing it in this person. And I understand why people don't like using the phone. It's difficult. You talk over each other. You can't always hear
right.
each other. It's complicated. But just because something's easy, which is communicating on text with a stranger is relatively easy compared to picking up the phone and having a conversation with a stranger, it doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. And I worry that we think we can fast forward the stages of getting to know someone. We can microwave them. And actually, they're always better by being simmered in a slow broth on mm-hmm. the back burner.
Right. Keep the cover on the pot.
Keep the cover on the pot.
Joanna Coles, Love Rules. Everyone wants a relationship, only it's hard. But she takes you by the hand and shows you that it is possible. You can have it, even in this crazy world. So thank you, Joanna.
Oh, my thanks to you, Joan. What a pleasure to be on the show.
We'll talk soon.
I look forward to it.
Me too. I'm Joan Hamburg. Joanna Coles, our guest. Love Rules, her book. Much more ahead on WABC.
New York culture with real New Yorkers. Joan Hamburg, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
All right, everyone, welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show. And women are really amazing. I want you to meet Nina Loris Collins, who's got a new book out, What Would Virginia Woolf Do? And Nina of course, went to my alma mater, Barnard College.
Barnard?
Went to Barnard. It changed my life.
Me too. It was amazing. That's so
It's amazing, right?
What
it was
year?
Like being a thrill. We never tell years, but
okay.
I'm telling you, when I went there, it was like being thrown in cold water, you know. Like,
really?
Oh, my gosh. In the middle of New York City, it wasn't what it is now. You know, we were living all over the place. I was living in a rooming house, and in the room next door to me was a hooker. And my mother kept saying, are you sure this is student housing? I said, oh, yeah, it is. We had great adventures.
Oh, I love that you went to Barnard. I feel like you meet, and when you meet Barnard women, they're always interesting. It's just amazing.
It's a great place.
Cool.
It's a special place. But Barnard is only one part. She's a very successful writer. She does all kinds of interesting things. She's had, like most human beings, a very complicated life. And she comes from a parent who was a wonderful writer and tragically died very young. But her new book is What Would Virginia Woolf Do? And it deals with aging, but a different kind of aging, because you point out, Nina, that you were just in your 40s when you started to get these symptoms, and you thought, what is going on?
That's right.
Right?
Yeah. When I was 46, I started not sleeping well suddenly. And I'd always been a great sleeper, and I was like, what is happening to me? And I did some research and realized I was at the beginning of perimenopause, that period kind of...
Between.
Yeah, that period between I described as kind of when you go from being relatively young to relatively old.
Right, and it's like sort of shocking because who needs it at that time?
And also because no one tells you about it. I mean, that was really the hard part for me. I had no idea all the things that were starting to happen to my body were coming. Most of my friends are older than I am, and because I had kids young, and so most of my friends are in their 50s. And I was just really surprised that no one had warned me about things like back fat and, you know.
Right, that you would suddenly start changing.
Yes.
And it's true. You can be the thinnest person in the whole world, but your body starts to change.
Yeah.
Gravity seems to disappear.
Yeah. With the decrease in estrogen, basically, there are a million. I mean, like, if you Google perimenopausal symptoms, there are 33 symptoms, and they're pretty much all linked to the decrease in estrogen.
So where did the book come from in the middle of all this? Because you were always doing a million things, writing and putting things together. And later I'm going to ask you about your mom, too, because you've been on many journeys with that.
Yeah, sure. Well, the book came about because basically I started having these perimenopausal symptoms and wanted to talk about it with my girlfriends. And I created a Facebook group, a secret Facebook group called What Would Virginia Woolf Do? The name is...
Interesting to pick Virginia Woolf because she did away with herself.
I know. The name is a dark joke. It's really basically I started this group for me and my friends who were mostly a bunch of kind of funny, literary-minded
feminists.
Right,
and you had been a literary agent,
I had been a literary agent. A lot of my friends are writers. And the joke is Virginia Woolf killed herself in her 50s. Maybe we should all just kill ourselves, which we still think is really funny, but it's sometimes hard to explain. So I started a Facebook group, and the Facebook group kind of grew and grew and started to take up more of my time. I was working on another book, a more literary memoir about my mother, and I had gotten a master's degree in something called narrative medicine. So at the time, I was doing some narrative medicine consulting.
And that's, I never heard of that till I read about you.
Yeah, it's a really interesting.
What is it?
People describe it in different ways. It's a program at Columbia. The way I describe it is it's the study of... the study of our experience, how we tell our stories in the context of death and dying. It's really
and
a
you
program.
You lived through that with your mother.
And I lived through that with my mother, exactly. My mom died when I was 19 of breast cancer that she kept a secret for
Amazing.
Many years. And it's really why I went to the program. I was writing a memoir about her and really wanting to understand more of her experience of why she kept her illness a secret and her experience of dying. And it led me to do some work. I worked at a hospital in Brooklyn called Maimonides, where I worked with, you know, in palliative care
right.
and with residents. And
always on this search. Did you ever, and I was trying to remember, find out why your mother decided to keep it a secret?
I think, you know, I'll never know for sure. I think it was a combination of... I think one part of her was probably trying to protect me, but honestly, I think more she was, it was kind of selfish. I mean, I think she was really didn't want to deal with other people's grief around what she was dealing with.
And she didn't want people to look at her.
She didn't want people to look at her
as a sick. You know, Nora Ephron chose that.
Yeah,
too.
I know. I was surprised when Nora Ephron
we
did
were
that.
All, I can't even tell you.
Yeah.
The 2 weeks before she died, we were all in the theater together. And as always, she had secret stashes of candy in her bag and was handing it out to everyone, looking terrific.
Wow.
And no one knew.
Yeah.
Not even her kids.
No, it was crazy. And it was the same thing with my mother. Yeah. It was 2 weeks before she died that her mother didn't even know. I mean, it was insane.
And so painful for you.
Yeah.
Because as a 19-year-old, you sort of even feel guilty. Like, what happened here?
It was horrible. And I was living abroad for the 9 months before she died. So, yeah, it's a huge sense of regret that I wasn't there with her. And I had so many questions. And, yeah, I wish she had handled it differently.
You know, we all do what we have to do at the moment. Nina Loris Collins, and I'm sure she knew that she had produced a strong child and that you would ultimately get through. And she left behind a really interesting trail and a legacy. You were brought up in a biracial family.
Yeah.
Were you, like the new royal bride, proud of your heritage as a kid, or was it complicated?
It wasn't. The racial stuff was never complicated for me, and I often wonder why. I mean, my mother was black, my father was white. My mother was a writer and a playwright and a filmmaker.
Yeah, really gifted.
Really gifted. Her work wasn't really known so much when she was alive, but it is now, thank God. She was very talented.
Because of you.
Because of me. And her work talks about race a lot, but when I was growing up, it just race was not an issue in our childhood. I have very few memories, a couple memories, you know, of being called an Oreo on the school bus, but I really never felt like
there was much
prejudice or isolation. No, and I've honestly always liked being half black and half white. I feel,
unique.
Yeah, and like a lot of people, I always feel slightly other, and I feel comfortable with it. Like I would never, usually if I have to choose one, I would probably identify more with being black because my mother was black and she raised us. But I really just kind of feel both, and that's fine.
Which is great. And then you found books and things that your mother had done.
Yeah.
Which you couldn't deal with for what, I think you said, 10 years.
Yeah, more than that, probably. So obviously growing up, I knew she was an artist, and I knew she made a film called Losing Ground. She made one called The Cruise Brothers when I was 10 in 1980, 10, 11, and then Losing Ground in 1982. But neither film was ever released. But I, of course, knew of them and loved them and was interested in her work, and then she died. And then for about, I guess, almost 20 years, all of her work just kind of lived in a trunk that I kind of carried around and never really read. And then I started going through it and reading her stories and her plays, and I ended up having her films released, and I sold a collection of short stories called Whatever Happened to Interracial Love, and they've all done really well.
To great
acclaim. Amazing. Yeah, it's really to great acclaim. It's been an amazing thing. When the film was released, it was included in a film festival at Lincoln Center, and I thought, oh, great, like now the film will be available,
right,
and a few people will see it, and that'll be the end of it. But then it got incredible reviews, and the New Yorker called her a genius. That was like a really huge moment for me.
And her daughter, who had the courage and the heart to pull all this together.
It's been really, it's been, like the Virginia Woolf stuff, I have to say, it's all been very surprising and organic.
And had life of its own.
That's right.
Well, and that's like, what would Virginia Woolf do? It's girlfriends talking to each other about every single thing, which we do.
Are you in the group by any chance?
No.
Oh, you should join the group.
I'm a bad belonger.
Oh, that's okay. So back to that story. So I started this group, and at the time I was doing this narrative medicine stuff, but then the group kind of started to take over my life. It became very demanding. The group now has 19,000 women, so it's become
this extraordinary,
very busy, interesting place where women are super candid and connect. And so basically I wrote the book because after about a year of doing the group, we only had around 1,200 women at the time, but it was taking up so much of my time, I thought I need to do something to justify spending all my time on Facebook because it wasn't a commercial venture. adventure. It was just a labor of love. And so then I wrote a book proposal and sold it, and that's how the book came about.
And the book deals with everything, whether it's what you're going to wear, to sex, to your kids, to your health, mm-hmm. to everything, to your work life. And it's funny, sad, real, and it talks about the things that we talk about to our close friends, as only women can do. Men can't do that.
Yeah.
They'll talk about hockey.
Right, exactly.
You know, or baseball.
Or politics. Yeah, no, I mean, basically the way I wrote the book is I looked at what the women in the group talk about, and I kind of broke it down into the major subjects, which you just covered. And then I kind of wrote my own take. The book is really my story, and then as you've read it, and then so fashion, beauty, kids, depression. And then I kind of branch out into experts. I talk to experts. I talk to my friends. I quote some of the Wolfers, which is what the women in the group call themselves. So I kind of describe it as like a funny, sexy, sometimes sad look at aging, because that's what we're
right.
talking about in the group.
And to try to put aging in a light without shame, because
absolutely.
We live in a society where, right, every day new stories about how to eliminate your lines, how to have new skin regime that will yeah. change you. Now, we all love that stuff, but it has to be with a sense of humor.
Absolutely. I mean, that's you've encapsulated it. I mean, for me, the whole project of the group and the book was to kind of say, there's nothing for us to be ashamed about, and we can, you know, let's. I mean, when I started the group, the idea for me was just to have a place to be kind of self-deprecating and funny about these issues that I was struggling with, because what else are you going to do but laugh about it and learn how to deal with it? And that's really what we do, you know.
Right, and you had other issues, having four kids very young.
Yeah.
Going through marriages that don't always work, but
yeah.
to be able to come out of them
yeah.
and say, it's okay.
Right, that's right.
You know, I'm on to the next,
yeah.
and I can deal.
Yeah, that's
instead
exactly.
of hiding under the covers, which is the impulse.
Oh, you'd be a perfect Wolfer. It's a shame you're not on Facebook. But yes,
I'm on
got
Facebook,
it.
But
okay.
we use it mostly for work, for our show.
But you've got the idea, exactly. And we've learned so much from each other. The women in the group are amazing, and you see all these stories of resilience and sadness and pain, and people are honest about the stuff that a lot of people don't want to talk about, and
right,
it's important.
The things that we do that we think we can keep under the covers,
that's right.
too.
That's right.
And yet, why not?
Why?
Right?
Right?
Exactly.
Exactly. It's that whole Brené Brown idea of vulnerability and the strength in being vulnerable.
And you've had a lot of adventures, too, which are fun to read about.
Thank you. Yes.
Going to Burning Man. You've got to read it, because you'll all get a big kick out of, you know, what Nina closing her eyes goes into. You know, whether it's, you know, a thing where they talk about group sex, but you're not sure whether it's really group sex? Or,
I didn't do actual group sex. There's a chapter in the book where I go to the orgy dome at Burning Man, but I went to the right, as they
explain
say.
Explain Burning Man. Not everyone knows what Burning Man is.
So Burning Man is this huge festival gathering in the desert the week
every
before
year.
Labor Day, every year in Nevada. And there's no money exchanged there. It's a giant gathering of people. There's this whole idea of leave no trace, and there's no exchange of money. So one of the things that's interesting about it is there's no commercialization. Like, you go there and you realize, oh my God, I'm in a place where there are no signs, there are no logos, right? It's just people in camps, and a lot of parties and a lot of dance music and a lot of art, huge art installations everywhere. And the fun part about it, for me, the most fun part, is that you bike around in the desert, and so at night it's really beautiful. It's crazy dusty, and it's ultimately, I think, really kind of hedonistic, and I don't think I'll go again. I've been twice.
Enough. You did it.
Twice was enough. The guy I went with really loved it, and I was like, he wanted to go back every year, and I was like, I just don't see why. There are other things I'd rather do. But the second year there, we went to this orgy dome, which is this this
Pot
tent
of Burning Man.
At Burning Man. But you can, I describe it in the book. Everyone should just read the book. But you can either go to the left or to the right. And if you go to the left, you're going to like the real orgy part. And right. if you go to the right, you're just having sex in public with other people.
Which just, is very brave.
Which is very brave. And it was a totally hilarious adventure and not something I ever thought I'd do.
And did you find it funny? Or
it was actually really fun and funny. And as I say in the book, it was really clean and everyone was really beautiful. And it was hilarious. I mean, the funny thing is at the time, like, I'm not a big one for secrets, as everyone who knows me knows. But at the time, we didn't tell the people we were with at Burning Man. We felt like I just didn't want everyone talking about it all week and wanting to go with us. But then like 6 or 7 months later, when I found myself writing the book and I was writing the sex chapter, it was just too good a story
so
to not write.
To
I just had to write it.
And I love because only women think like that. When you commented on how clean everything
yeah.
was. Because before thinking about the sex, are people going to watch? How are you going to walk naked in a group of strangers?
Right.
You're looking to see if it's clean.
Totally. We brought our own sheet.
I yeah. know. I thought that was really... I mean, there are so many moments of truth in what would Virginia Woolf do. So whether... you're starting menopause, whether you're in menopause, whether you're past it, it's really about aging, the joys, the sorrows, and getting through life. It's not easy, but it's okay.
Yeah.
Give yourself a sense of humor and a lot of strength. Come to grips with, even in your case, your mother, mm-hmm. who did the best she could do. You know, when you think about your mom dying in her 40s, she didn't have time to be discovered.
Yeah.
You know, it just didn't fit into that limited framework.
Yeah.
So
no, I know. It's
part of your destiny.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Nina. All the best to you.
Thank you so much.
What would Virginia Woolf do? And other questions I ask myself as I attempt to age without apology. Available in all the bookstores, online, and everywhere else. I'm Joan Hamburg for WABC.